Good morning. The G8 caravan of world leaders rolled into Fermanagh on Monday. The object of the two-day summit was to reach consensus on the three T's, tax, trade and transparency, and to bridge the gulf between Russia and the rest of the other G8 leaders on the war in Syria. But before the official gathering began, President Obama addressed an audience of young people at the waterfront in Belfast. He said that people in conflict zones around the world were looking to Northern Ireland for a blueprint on establishing peace.
It's been 15 years now since the Good Friday Agreement, since clenched fists gave way to outstretched hands. And the people of this island voted in overwhelming numbers to see beyond the scars of violence and mistrust and to choose to wage peace. This island is now chic, and these daily moments of life in a bustling city, a changing country, for that's what your parents and grandparents dreamt for all of you. To travel without the burden of checkpoints or roadblocks or seeing soldiers on patrol. To enjoy a sunny day free from the ever-present awareness that violence could blacken it at any moment. To befriend or fall in love with whomever you want.
It's estimated that £50 million was spent on security for the summit, and there was a large police presence around Enniskillen. But maybe it was the remoteness of the location of the luxury hotel on Lough Erne, but the expected hordes of protesters failed to materialise. They were mostly homegrown activists. However, Valerie Cox met up with some of the seasoned anti-GAA protesters who did travel.
You came from Glasgow?
From Blackhill, Glasgow, to here. This is my son's second G8 with the dog. We brought the dog as well. It's the dog's second G8.
Where's the dog?
She's in the car sleeping. She's exhausted. I've always wanted to visit Enniskillen because I know about the past troubles. And I'm here to voice my... No voice, my opinion. Just to be my presence. Peaceful presence.
Hello. You're another protester.
Yes, I am.
Why are you sitting here in your underwear with the dog?
Because I was out... It was too cold outside to stand all day like this. So I went to check my social media. And I'm going to have a shower.
Why are you here?
I'm here to protest because I know these people in the G8 have got the power to feed the world. There's enough food in the world to feed the world twice round over. Yet there's some people sitting with surplus of food. Yet there's people who don't have any money for anything. It's not fair and it can be changed.
Was it difficult to get to Enniskillen?
It was okay. I drove from Glasgow to Trun, got a ferry from Trun to Larne. Drove from Larne to Belfast, then from Belfast to here. So it was okay.
And the dog came with you?
Yes, Grace came with us. She's a veteran. She was also at Glen Eagles with us. 2005.
While President Obama was busy with world affairs in Enniskillen, it was FLOTUS who stole the show in Dublin. Michelle Obama travelled south with her daughters Sasha and Malia. They had a jam-packed schedule. First stop was Trinity College to trace their lineage, and then it was on to the Gaiety Theatre for a special performance of Riverdance. Samantha Librari caught the atmosphere for Morning Ireland.
There was delight when the Obamas arrived at the university, and as they spent an hour inside learning about their lineage, some lingered to try and catch another glimpse. But for most, it ended in disappointment.
I was straining to see as she went in, but I'm actually very disappointed.
Had you waited here long?
About an hour, yeah.
And what did you see?
Nothing much, just hand waving through a dark window, yeah, that was it.
Did you get to see Michelle?
No.
No.
Not at all.
Had you been waiting long?
We were waiting an hour.
An hour, yeah.
What did you see?
Just the top of her head, that's all.
Oh well.
You glad you came anyway?
Of course I am.
Yeah, it's a great sense of occasion here, you know.
But a select few got FaceTime with the first family.
Patrick Prendergast, the Provost of Trinity College Dublin. I had the pleasure of introducing the Obama girls to my two daughters. They swapped some stories about being in New York and what to do when you're in New York. So that was good.
My name is Anne-Marie Diffley. I'm the Visitor Services Manager in the old library building. It was a wonderful, happy, warm visit.
The Gaiety Theatre was the first family's second stop of the day. Among the invited guests, their distant cousin Henry Healy and Moneygall publican Ollie Hayes.
It's phenomenal, I suppose, that they continue to include us in everything that they do.
Was there a disappointment that they didn't go to Moneygall?
No one seems to be too disappointed, and the First Lady herself this morning told us that they do intend to return again to Ireland, and Moneygall has to be visited yet by Sasha Malia. Those, so it doesn't matter, they can come at any time. Moneygall is always going to be there, but you know, it's fabulous that they've honoured their promise and came back to Ireland.
And it was the children she mainly spoke to when Michelle Obama took to the stage before Riverdance.
I want you all to think really big about who you want to be. I want your imaginations to soar high. I want you to look at me and Barack and all these wonderful leaders and understand that we are you, just kids who worked a little hard and dreamt pretty big and got to do some wonderful things.
30 Moneygall school children got the biggest surprise of the day when they were taken backstage to meet Mrs. Obama face to face.
She said to finish up strong in school and she'd hope to be back for a visit soon.
And what was she like?
She was really tall and really kind.
She was just telling us that there's a lot of work being the First Lady and she has to be going around everywhere. And she's doing a lot of stuff. She's very busy.
She treated us like we were famous and stuff instead of her. I was like, you're Michelle Obama. She was just like, it's really nice to meet you guys and stuff. It's so funny.
On Tuesday, the second day of the visit, the sun shone over the lakes at Glendalough and it was pure picture postcard when Michelle Obama and her daughters toured the monastic site. Afterwards, it was a pub lunch in Finnegan's Dalkey with local rock star Bono and his wife Ellie Hewson. Lee's Hand of the Irish Independent was in the thick of it.
I saw a photograph tweeted which had you right beside the car as Bono welcomed them to Finnegan's in Dalkey.
They had a leisurely lunch in Dalkey that, you know, went on longer than, say, a normal sort of formal grip and grin, sort of doing it for form's sake. They all were hunkered away in a corner in Finnegan's pub in Dalkey. They all tucked into fish and chips, apparently. They put the kids on one table, so that would be Sasha and Malia, and then Bono's two sons, who would be roughly the same age, Elijah and John, and they all sat at one table while the grown-ups sat at the other table, which, you know, it's kind of a really kind of classic Irish lunch, you know, it was quite cute. And the First Lady and the two left in the cavalcade, and it was a wonderful, it was actually quite a carnival atmosphere. The streets were lined with locals who had come for a look, and then Bono came out afterwards. And, you know, Bono said that they'd had a lovely lunch and that Michelle had enjoyed Glendalough very much. He also said, which is quite nice, he said that she loves Irish women and, you know, said that Irish women seem to love her back, which I think was a fair point.
And you were in Glendalough earlier as well. Yes. Were the midges hard at work?
Oh, Lord, the midges were just savage. They really were. It's funny, you know, that you could see this a lot of the Secret Service, I think, getting bitten quite badly as well. I mean, they can defend against all kinds of weaponry, but the flying insect is one that they haven't figured out how to actually quell. And you could see the two kids particularly were, you know, were kept on swatting at themselves when they were walking about. But, you know, it didn't really detract from the trip.
No, and you know what? It's worth it. Glendalough is absolutely, absolutely beautiful.
It's beautiful. And, I mean, the place looked so gorgeous today, the sunshine. And they had a fantastic guide, George McLafferty, who took them around.
Lee's Hand with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. So far, so good, you might think. However, the American networks were reporting that the Obama girls, Sasha and Malia, were bored stiff on the visit.
Mom, Malia's on Facebook stalking Justin Bieber again.
Put it away, Malia.
Okay, but don't forget my birthday is in a few weeks. Dad promised me that gift.
I know, but he'll give you Bieber's phone records only if you behave. Now we're almost at Glendalough.
Is that near Tato Park?
No, honey. We're going to see where the monks lived.
Mom, you can't be serious. First we spent an hour with some old book. It didn't even have a Horcrux in it.
Then that awful line dancing thing and now this.
Oh, it can't get any worse.
We're having lunch with Uncle Bono.
Scratch that.
So, Bono, the girls are just loving Europe.
Great, and I know you're going to Berlin next. Shame you're missing Amsterdam, though. It is pure heaven.
You mean a haven, right?
What?
Good one, Sasha. Girls, manners, please. Sorry, Bono.
It's okay. You know, I'm writing a song about it to help the world hear the beautiful echo of Amsterdam as its voice rings out like the trombone of 1,000 angels.
I know. We read your emails in Air Force One.
What?
I think the chorus needs a bridge.
Excuse me?
Never mind the girls.
Oh.
Be nice to Uncle B.
Where exactly do you live?
Nearby in Killiney.
What are the map coordinates?
Oh, you're looking it up on Google Maps. A lot of my fans...
No, I'm just texting Dad about where to send his next drone. I'm
sorry, Bono. The girls are just a little impatient with the vacation.
It's okay, I totally get it. Even at my age, I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
Maybe if you took off those stupid sunglasses, you might have more luck.
Oliver Callan and the Obama Gals heard on Callan's Kicks last night. And there was someone else who was not enamoured of the visit. Independent TD Claire Daly cut up rough in the Dáil on Wednesday, accusing the Taoiseach of slobbering over the Obamas and prostituting and pimping the country for a pat on the head.
Whether it's the outpourings of the Obamas themselves or the sycophantic fawning over them by sections of the media and the political establishment. We've had separate and special news bulletins by the state broadcaster to tell us what Michelle Obama and her daughters had for lunch in Dublin, but very little questioning of the fact that she was having lunch with Mr. Tax Exile himself. And you, Taoiseach, you are the one who's turned a blind eye on these activities. You've talked about the G8 being an opportunity to showcase Ireland. But is it not a reality that you have showcased us as a nation of pimps prostituting ourselves in return for a pat on the head? To be honest with you, we were really speculating this morning whether you were going to deck the cabinet out in leprechaun hats decorated with a bit of stars and stripes to really mark abject humiliation here.
And on the Today Show on Thursday, Miles Dungan spoke with Claire Daly and with Junior Tourism Minister Michael Ring.
Well, the Taoiseach Claire Daly has described your comments as disgraceful. Are you, on reflection, prepared to withdraw them or at least admit that elements of them were a bit over the top?
They certainly weren't. There's nothing insulting at all, actually. It's a tribute, isn't it, to the sort of American way of life that people can express a free opinion and a different view. And I was simply making the point because what we were subjected to over the past number of days has been just, yeah, unquestioning slobbering, really, to be honest, you know. I mean, I had made points about the G8 in general last week, about the overall hypocrisy of all of the G8 leaders. The reason why I singled out Obama yesterday was precisely because of the monolithic viewpoint around their visit, and it was just in response to that to get a bit of balance, particularly in relation to the areas of where President Obama poses himself as an ambassador for peace, but in actual fact his foreign policy is doing the opposite, and I think that needs to be corrected. And I think we as a nation have a lot to offer as an independent country with an independent foreign policy. We don't need to showcase ourselves just by running around and doffing the cap. I think those days are gone.
Michael Ring, do you agree with the Taoiseach? Do you think also that Claire Daly's comments were disgraceful?
Well, I think I was very disappointed to hear her comments yesterday, and for the last year, we've been working very hard, particularly at tourism level, to try and bring people into this country. There's 185,000 people employed in the tourism industry in this country. For the last number of days, this country has been beamed all over the world, and Falch Ireland and Tourism Ireland would never have a budget to be able to sell the beauty. And we were so lucky with the beautiful weather that we had, and certainly the background where people saw what we had to offer.
There are elements other than tourism involved here. Isn't it at the very least ironic that while her husband discusses tax avoidance in Fermanagh, Michelle Obama is having lunch with an Irishman who chooses to place much of his funds offshore? Perfectly legitimately, but that's his choice.
Yes, but he still pays a substantial amount of tax in this country, and I would wish that he would pay all his tax in the country, but that's his choice, and you're quite correct. But at the same time, he has done a lot of good for this country. He's a world figure, pop star. Thousands upon thousands of people all over the world come in to see him. He sells the same image of Ireland as we want to sell. And the kind of publicity we got over the last number of years, we couldn't pay for that publicity.
Minister Michael Ring with Claire Daly. In Melbourne, Australia, the man who raped and murdered Jill Maher last September was given a life sentence. The judge ordered that Adrian Bailey must serve at least 35 years before he'd be considered for parole. Adrian Bailey killed Jill when he was out on parole for another crime, and he already had a criminal record for raping five women. RTE's Katrina Perry was in court when the sentence was handed down.
It must be said that the judge essentially said he didn't quite buy a lot of what Adrian Bailey had said, and he said that he was evidently a man who derived sadistic pleasure from hurting women, and that he was determined to have his way with Jill one way or the other, and matters were just made worse when she became annoyed with him. He made a lot of very strong comments saying that in terms of moral culpability, the killing of Jill Maher ranked amongst the worst kind conceivable, and that nothing short of a life sentence would suffice for Adrian Bailey, and thus that's what he handed down.
Jill's husband, Tom Maher, criticised the sentence and the Australian justice system. He spoke with Louise Milligan of ABC Television.
I don't think anything's enough. I can't think of a worse person than that man. I wasn't expecting the judge to hand down life without parole, simply because people had told me this wouldn't happen. I certainly don't think the sentence for rape charge was enough at all. Given what this man has done in the past, I think that 15 years is a disgrace, considering the maximum penalty for rape is 25. And I don't know what the maximum penalty is for if it's not for that man. I don't know who else could fit the bill of a maximum sentence for rape than Adrian Ernest Bailey.
Part of the reason why the judge said he gave the sentence that he did was because he said that Bailey expressed some degree of remorse. What did you think about that? I mean, did you think he was remorseful, and did you think that it mattered?
No. I don't see how he was remorseful. I don't see a man who continually does the same thing over and over again can be considered remorseful. No, I don't think it matters at all. Like, it would matter in maybe some cases, but not in the case of a serial offender, not in the case of somebody who keeps doing it over and over again. If he has a little cry, I mean, I don't know what difference that makes to sentencing at all. It's baffling. It's bewildering to sit there and listen to somebody sort of coddle this man with ideas of remorse. And, you know, who cares if he has remorse?
And Tom Marr spoke of the heartbreak at losing his beautiful wife.
Now, just casting your mind back, before the reasons that we're here today, to Jill.
Mm.
If I was to meet Jill, say, 2 years ago, what sort of person would I have met?
You would have met... Sorry, you would have met the funniest girl in the world. Sorry.
It's okay.
She was incredibly funny, incredibly witty, and just so smart and intelligent that she was the she just brightened up any room she was in. It took ages to kind of separate my memories of her from what happened to her, you know. So it's kind of I love to think about her, but it's often very intrusive, and something will just pop into your head, and you know it comes out of nowhere, and then it's difficult to separate. But you know it's worth it to try. It's worth it to remember Jill. So that's what I try to do. That part of it's never over until you finally see that monster gone. You know, so. Hopefully I can just cut him out of my life, and of course he'll always be there, but I mean, I don't want him there. So I want to think of Jill. I don't want to think of him.
Marr remembering his late wife Jill, heard on Drive Time. Veronica's son Stephen was murdered 4 years ago. His body was dumped in Ballydonnell Woods. One man is serving life for the murder, and this week a second man got 8 years for his manslaughter. As Veronica told Joe Duffy, Stephen was happy, inquisitive and intelligent as a child, and his family did everything to help him when he got into drugs.
Stephen was murdered. He was left in the woods. We were told he was missing.
Yeah.
And it was some real sort of terrified feeling we had when the guards told us Stephen was missing. And a long time left then, until Stephen's body was found in a shallow grave in Ballydonnell Woods. We sort of walked through the woods and hoping we'd find him, at the same time dreading, you know, finding him. In the end, he was found about 50 metres from where we used to look. But like that, it would have been so simple for somebody to make the call, you know, and say Stephen was there, so that we could have told his, you know, at least we would have been able to tell his partner and his children, you know, where he was, and we would have had something, you know. On Christmas Eve, we got a phone call from the guards to tell us that Stephen's body had been found up in the woods, and we had to go on this cold, snowy Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And bring our son out of the woods. His eldest young child was only 5 at the time, and he was with Stephen an awful lot. He was very attached to Stephen.
Yeah.
And like, your heart would break now when you see him there at the funeral, putting the flower into the grave and standing there with Stephen's photograph in his hand. And he still has that photograph over his bed, and he never stops talking about his dad. Every time we see love hate, when we saw love hate, we couldn't, you know, we just could not believe this was what people were raving about, you know.
Because this is the reality for you.
Yeah.
from Tuesday's Liveline. Paddy O'Gorman visited Borna Breena Cemetery during the week. He met a woman who goes to the graveyard four times a week to visit her grandson, who committed suicide at the age of 18.
He loved his music and he loved his motorbikes.
And Manchester United, you've all that's on the grave, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And he died 2.5 years ago now.
Suicide.
Suicide. I'm so very sorry.
In the reservoir.
And does it make you feel any better to come here?
Oh, yeah, it does. It makes you feel so much better, you know. Mm-hmm. The thought that, like, that we are looking after him, even though he's dead. We did it when he was alive. See, I reared him from kind of early age. His mother was a junkie. And I reared three of them. Right. Not just him. I have another two boys as well.
And was his mother your daughter?
Yes, she was my daughter.
And is she living still?
She's still alive, yeah.
So like many grandmothers who were pressed into service to raise the children?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was something I chose to do myself because they were my grandchildren, you know.
Can you ever understand why somebody would take their own life?
I don't understand, but do you know the way he was in a dark hole at the time and there's nothing could have stopped it, you know.
Do you believe you'll ever see him again?
Oh yeah, I'll see him in the next life without a doubt and he'll get a clatter off me. Kick up the arse, he'll get off me, you know.
Paddy O'Gorman reporting for the Today Show. Nobody likes dealing with the ageing process, but some good news. Apparently 50 is the new 30. Fiona Looney and Gary Cook were weighing up the pros and cons with Miriam O'Callaghan.
Is it a myth that 50 is the new 30? Is it a terrible cliche at this stage?
Well, I don't think it is a myth. And I think most people, if they look at a photograph of their parents at our age, and it doesn't really matter what our age is, it's kind of any age, if you know what I mean. Your parents certainly dressed older. I mean, I'm here, I've got ridiculously long hair. Miriam, you've got ridiculously long hair. We would have been kind of burnt as witches, you know, back in the day. I mean, there was this awful, and I find actually very depressing tradition in this country.
Is it similar for guys, do you think, Gary?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people talk about 50, you may think that you're not 50. You may fool other people that you're not 50, but you won't fool your body that you're not 50. You know, I find like bending down now is becoming, you kind of go, oh, every time you bend down or, you know.
When you start to think, is there anything else I can do while I'm down here?
Well, exactly. also when you go into the supermarket, you know, and you come out and you kind of go, where did I leave the car? Where did I leave?
Yeah, we all
you know,
do
and
that.
You remember, Dottie, older people when you were younger and now I've become one.
What you can't fool, and I find this really depressing, are your eyes. Because what starts to happen, as everybody of our age knows, is that, you know, it doesn't matter if you have the best eyesight in the world, suddenly somebody hands you a menu and you have to kind of judge the distance at which you can actually read it.
I know.
You see people just holding stuff further and further away. We're really good at reading the specials board, but the menu ain't going to happen anymore. Funny enough, like that, I was talking to an older woman a few years ago and I was lamenting how quickly my own kids were growing up and I was saying, I can't believe, like, it's barbaric how quickly that passes. And I was kind of saying, you know, and then it's over. And she actually said, and I know this sounds very depressing, but she said, no, she said, once they're gone, she said, you get a whole new lease of life. She said, your parents have also gone, so you don't have the responsibility and the worry of looking after them. And she was, this woman was
so
in her 70s.
Window of opportunity.
And she said, it's brilliant. She said, you know, hopefully you've got a little bit of retirement money. You're off, you're travelling, you don't have the responsibilities and you can go mad all over again.
Simple, really. Liveline listener Mary turns 50 next Monday. And to mark the occasion, she took part in the Westport Mini Triathlon last Saturday. This involves a sea swim, a 20k cycle and a 5k run. Mary was freezing when she came out of the water after the sea swim, and as she was changing out of her togs, she had a wardrobe malfunction. She spoke with Joe Duffy on Thursday.
So what happened? You were swimming, you came out of the water, and what happened?
Well, I was trying to get changed, which is very difficult because the sea is very cold at the moment. But I survived that, and I got out, and I took my wetsuit off, and I had a bathing suit on, which I just brought down to my waist to dry myself and get then into the top of my running gear. Mm-hmm. And at that point, one of the marshals approached me with a red card and told me I was disqualified. And of course, I didn't know why I was disqualified. I thought I had been in time from the swim. So he told me I was disqualified because of nudity.
Yeah, but when he flashed a red card at you, you had slipped down your one-piece bathing suit, obviously, before you took it off, and you were just going to throw on, what, a bra and a T-shirt quickly.
Exactly.
That was the idea. You weren't strutting around naked.
No, not at all. And okay. Also, I must explain to you that after these sea swims, your hands are completely numb.
We've been on to the triathlon organisers, and they say it's the Irish Triathlon Union, and they say the appendix, which you have been disqualified, Appendix K, is for nudity or indecent exposure.
But I totally disagree. And also, I saw a couple of gentlemen's bare backsides. None of them were pulled up for the same reason. So I just, well, it's maybe, the inequality is my problem here.
Well, in fairness, maybe the man with the red card who was flashing it around, flashed it at you, didn't see the bare bums.
Well, when I noticed bare bottoms, I completely averted my eyes out of dignity, as one would.
As you would, yeah.
I feel it's very unfair. And my request really is that Westport Mini Triathlon put my name back up on the results as second last with my time.
And happy birthday to Mary next Monday from Thursday's Liveline.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Today is a big day for the extended Kennedy clan, who are commemorating the visit of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy to his ancestral home in Dungannstown in County Wexford 50 years ago. His sister, Jean Kennedy Smith, accompanied him on that trip. She later, of course, served as US ambassador to Ireland and played a significant role in the peace process. She spoke with Cathal McCullough on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
Was the visit to the family homestead and meeting Mary Ryan, who I think was a third cousin of the president,
yes,
in Dungannstown near New Ross, was that one of the highlights?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you see, we were brought up by my mother to realise that the Irish were very, there was a great prejudice in Boston against the Irish. And of course, they felt that because they couldn't get in to any clubs or bring us to clubs so we could swim in the beach on the water and all. That's why we ended up at the Cape, because it's way down from Boston.
Even for a Kennedy, prejudice was something you were aware of?
That was in the days when no Irish need apply. It was all around Boston.
In your mother's time or in your time?
Yes, absolutely, in my mother's time. And so they couldn't get into any clubs because they were Irish. So they were very conscious of being in the persecution that went on here, because, you know, it affected my father very, and his businesses and things. He had to be careful about different things. And it was very obvious around Boston.
The fact that you're back here now to take part in this various events commemorating this visit, what does it mean for you now after all these years and after all that involvement in Irish affairs at different levels by you?
I think it's very nice that so many young people came, so many young people in our family came who have never been before.
Jean Kennedy Smith. Our own President Michael D. Higgins visited the RTÉ studios on Tuesday to deliver the Michael Littleton Memorial Lecture. His theme, the 1913 lockout, its sources, impact and some lessons. The main thrust of the lecture was a commemoration of our collective past and the events that have made us who we are today. The President underlined this point in relation to young people and how they learn about the past.
Most young men and women at the century's end grow up in a sort of permanent present, lacking any organic relation to the public past of the times they live in. Without good history teaching, there is no shared idea of a public past. And now, more than ever, with a contemporary crisis and a decade's commemoration of a fascinating and difficult past, we need to empower all our citizens with an appreciation of how we got to where we are. This is not invoking any cliche about learning the lessons of history. Rather, it is about seeing history as essential to understanding who we are today, and more importantly, who we might be in cooperation with others in the future. Knowledge of history is intrinsic to citizenship. To have no knowledge of the past is to be permanently burdened with a lack of perspective, empathy, or wisdom. Knowledge of history allows us to debunk myths and challenge inaccuracy, as well as to expose deliberate amnesia or invented versions of the past. It enables us to understand the formation of identity and the significance of diversity, nuance, and context. It is thus knowledge we can bring to all experiences and walks of life. To not embrace and reflect on history is to reject an essential cultural endeavor. to not think about evidence, proof, and the methods of researching the past is to ignore crucial tool of enlightenment and empowerment.
President Michael D. Higgins from a special programme on the 1913 lockout presented by John Bowman and produced by Kevin Reynolds. Michael Collins and Catherine Joyce have been married for 27 years. Michael is a well-known actor who first came to prominence in Glenroe. Catherine runs the Blanchardstown Traveller Development Group. In keeping with traveller tradition, they were both originally promised to other people in an arranged marriage. They told Miriam O'Callaghan how they ended up together.
Well, I mean, in the travelling community, young people, when they turn 16 or 17 years of age, are usually matched off to other people. It's almost, you know, a first cousin or a second cousin and stuff like that. But then sometimes just things don't work out, you know, and it just didn't work out for me, and I don't think it worked out for Catherine.
For years, everybody thought Michael's wedding was broke off because of me, but it actually wasn't. His wedding was broke off before he ever met me.
Yeah.
And likewise with mine. Mine was actually broke off before we moved up to Dublin. But again, we were very young, and they were arranged weddings, and neither of the two of us wanted to marry the people that we were matched off with. And lucky enough, we were given a situation where we had a choice about that. Yeah. And we ended up meeting each other then the following summer. So the rest is history.
And did your respective parents mind, like in your case, Catherine, was it a big deal for Michael? Did he have to ask your parents for you to
marry? Of course he did. Yeah. Yeah. And before he came out to ask, I had to ask my mother to ask my father, would it be okay for him to come out? So, yeah.
And when you asked your mum, can you remember, was she okay about it?
She was okay with it. And my father said that he would break his two legs and arms.
God, that was a nice thought for you, Michael.
Well, I tell you, it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. I mean, I've worked on stage 101 times where I had audiences of maybe 250, 300 people. Yeah. And going out to ask that man for his daughter was one of the hardest things I ever done. I remember sitting on the bunk of the trailer, like, and of course all Catherine's cousins came in, who were all women, to have a look. And then the mother came in, and there was no men there. And then the father came in, and I remember the sweat just running along me back into me boxer shorts. And I just stood there, and he just turned around and he says, do you have something to ask me? And I said, yeah, Mike, I came out to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage. And he goes, ah, right, well, ever what she thinks herself. And he walks out. I would have come out earlier, because she kept trying to get me out for a couple of weeks, but I kept putting off.
Oh, I kept saying to him, if you're going to come out, you better come out now, because my mother and father is expecting you out. And he kept saying, no, I'll come out next week, I'll come out next week.
Yeah, but
the truth of the matter was, he was terrified of my father.
Well, geez, you told me he was going to break my legs. What did you expect me to do?
From Miriam Meets Last Sunday, produced by Eileen Herron. Another actor, Sir Michael Gambon, was in Dublin for the Actors' Forum at the Gate Theatre last weekend. He's best known for his portrayal of Dumbledore in Harry Potter and as Lord of the Manor in Gosford Park, but he was actually born in Dublin. He grew up in Camden Town in London. He was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
You started out in a profession that was to do with mechanical things.
I was a precision engineer. I loved that. And I served a 7-year apprenticeship, and then I started drifting out of it and became an actor without really trying. I just drifted into it. I didn't go to drama school. I wasn't trained, told lots of lies and got jobs.
I rather particularly liked the lies that you told Micheál MacLaymore.
Oh, yeah. I flew to Dublin and I had an interview with him, and I told him I was on my way to New York to make a film. I mean, unimaginable. And he believed that. And I said, would I be able to do your next play? Would I be in your next play? He said, oh, certainly, yes. When are you back from New York? And I said, well, I'll be back tomorrow. So I ended up going to all over Europe with MacLaymore's company doing Othello.
Right.
I didn't have a big part, just walking on.
You had an arrangement to meet them. You rang them at 3 o'clock in the morning?
I had an airplane taking me to Dublin, but the pilot, we had terrible weather. He couldn't land, and so he then went to Cork. We had to stay in hotels overnight, and I rang MacLaymore on the number I had and woke him up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he just grunted and shouted. But he made an announcement to the company, all gathered in the rehearsal room. The second gentleman of Cyprus rang me at 3 o'clock last night, woke me up, and he told me not to worry, he'll be here at 11. So we're all to wait for him. You know, I didn't even have lines to say.
What did you have to do?
Well, first of all, would you, apart from walking on in your costume, would you come to my dressing room every night during the half hour, and I'd take all my clothes off, and you could rub me with oil all over my body. It made me feel fresh, and then helped me get into my costume. And I didn't like that very much. I said, I'm sorry, I won't do that. He said, well, get the hell out of it. And he never spoke to me again.
Really?
Yeah. But I was in the show.
Yeah.
All over Europe.
Right.
But Marion wasn't buying into the stories.
I'm a little wary of some of your stories because I understand that you told another journalist that you started life as a ballet dancer.
I did.
And you told another person that you had been a homosexual but you gave it up because it brought tears to your eyes.
Yeah, it made my eyes water.
Yeah.
But I'm always tempted in front of these journalists, you know, to tell them lies.
Right.
I mean, I said I was a ballet dancer and he said, why did you give it up? I said, well, I was at the Royal Opera House and I fell off the stage during one of my big numbers and my head went through the kettle drum. He must have been an idiot because he wrote it down.
Right.
I mean, you wouldn't believe, that, would they?
Do I believe the story about Mark Learmore and the oil and taking off all the clothes?
That the oil is true, and that's true about the clothes off, and it's true about me ringing him up from Cork.
Michael Gambon with Marion Finucane. Former Ireland soccer player Damien Duff rarely gives interviews, but he spoke with Miriam O'Callaghan in his role as ambassador for Heart Children Ireland. His son Woody had heart surgery when he was a tiny baby.
And you met this other little boy and he also had heart surgery and he's a young Fulham fan called Macaulay Rogers. But I think this is really sweet because he's a very good interviewer and he asked you some tough questions recently. Let's listen to this.
Okay, Mr. Duff, I know you're very intense, but do you ever smile? What makes you smile? Relax.
You make me smile. I don't know, you probably just see me on the football pitch. So it's a lot more intense out there than maybe everyday life and out in the training pitch and what have you. So, but to be fair, you're not the only person that said that. My mum tells me to smile more as well. So now that you have said it, I will try and smile more. And when I do smile, I will think of you. Okay, Macaulay?
And Damien also spoke about his plans to settle back home here in Ireland.
You love Ireland, don't you? You've never actually bought a house in England. I mean, your plan is to come back and live here.
Yeah, I'm renting. I'm at Fulham in London at the minute. And yeah, we've just bought a house down in Wicklow about 6 months ago. And that's where I'm planning on living for the rest of my days with the fam, yeah.
Why do you want to both come back and live in Ireland? Elaine's from Bray, isn't she?
Elaine's from Bray, yeah. I'm obviously from Ballyboden. Just, it's where your heart is, your home, and yeah, your mom, your dad, your brothers and your sisters. And I want my kids to grow up Irish and play with their cousins and just be Irish. So yeah, it's a no-brainer really. So when I hang up my boots in England, I'll be on the next flight home.
And sometimes when you look at, say, when you're in your young days and you were under Brian Kerr and it was just such a really hopeful moment with Robbie Keane and stuff, do you look back to those days fondly on the Irish team?
I do, yeah. I was only texting about 3-4 weeks ago. I think I was just driving somewhere. I was just remembering the good old days when myself and Robbie and we're in the underage teams and what have you, just saying what great times there were. So, yeah, listen, absolutely amazing. And while I'm on, just like fantastic work and congratulations to Robbie for last week. They're two records now that will probably never be broken.
Former Republic of Ireland soccer star Damien Duff.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
On Wednesday, the government announced plans to further slash the number of teaching hours for children with autism and Asperger's and other special needs. The Irish National Teachers Organisation described the cuts as savage, and callers to Joe Duffy told stories of what life is like on the front line coping with these vulnerable children. Brigitte's 7-year-old son has Down syndrome. He's non-verbal and is not toilet trained.
I do know that I will go and reobserve the situation next October, November. That's not looking much good to me come the 2nd of September when he goes into school. And a phone call comes that I have to go and change him. He's had an accident. And they don't have the support in school to manage the changing of a nappy. So you can't have any sort of a life. You know, that life for me might be just going off and having a cup of coffee. No, you have to bring a phone with you everywhere you go to go and change your child's nappy.
Yeah,
you know, Joe, I'd keep him at home. I would keep him at home tomorrow because he's the most adorable, lovable child. Maybe that's what I do. Maybe that's what I do and let them put me into Mountjoy for not sending him to school. That'll cost more money, won't it?
From Wednesday's Liveline. The actor James Gandolfini, best known for his role as Tony Soprano in the cult series The Sopranos, died suddenly this week at the age of 51. On Arena, comedian A.B. Philbin Bowman remembered him.
The Sopranos kick-started a golden age of television drama, in part because James Gandolfini gave us a fully formed, morally ambiguous, utterly believable character. A mob boss who couldn't control his teenagers, suffered from depression, and needed to go to therapy. a man who ruthlessly orders hits on fellow mafia bosses, but whose elderly, infirm mother has him wrapped around her little finger.
You're not going to die. Your stuff's not going to be hauled off to the dump. But you do have to start planning for your future. You got the most rewarding chapter of your life coming up.
You know my good jewelry?
The stuff Dad gave you. Yeah, some of those pieces came right out of Cartier's window, huh? Simcom doesn't want it. Not now. What we both want is for you to live long and wear your sparklers to your grandchildren's graduations.
I gave it all to your cousin Josephine.
What the fuck, the good jewelry?
She always admired it. They don't have much money.
You gave a fucking cousin Cartier dinner rings and you give me a vibrating chair?
Your wife never showed any interest in my jewels. She never complimented me on any of it, as I can remember.
You listen to me now. Before you do any more serious damage to yourself or your grandchildren's inheritance, you're going to stop living alone right now.
I'm not going to that nursing home.
From A.B. Philbin Bowman's report for Arena. Well, the shops are full of luscious strawberries at the moment, so evocative of summer. For the Today Show, Mary Louise O'Donnell went strawberry picking in Enniscorthy and ended her report with a gorgeous poem.
Can I leave you with one small thing from Dennis O'Driscoll, who died, as we know, he was a great friend of yours, Dennis, and a wonderful poet, who wrote about the strawberry, and he said it was a sunset ripple on your plate, a cordet locket, meaning a heart locket, a precious stone, cut one and expose the marble core, the wholesome rubicundity of outdoors, compact, meaty, flecked with seeds, a July day provides the ideal accompaniment, lazy as the cream dripping from the whisk.
Dennis O'Driscoll, a precious stone himself.
Correct.
Mary Louise O'Donnell with Miles Dungan. The village of Doolin in County Clare has long been a place of pilgrimage for devotees of traditional music, and last weekend RTE Radio 1's music shows decamped to the village. John Creedon was there, Kieran Hanrahan was back on his home turf with Cayley House, and the South Wind Blows travelled up the coast from West Kerry. Well, one of Philip King's guests was Luca Bloom, who remembered his first visit to Doolin.
1973, the year we joined the EU, I witnessed the first German invasion of Ireland. I was 17 years of age. I was shocked everyone by getting a half-decent leaving cert, and the mother, under pressure, agreed to give me the loan of the Wolseley on condition that I wasn't driving to go to this exotic destination in the west of Ireland that I'd been hearing about called Doolin. And I arrived down and we parked the car up behind Gussie O'Connor's pub and walked in to a sea of rucksacks, beards and braless young students from Germany, and it was another world to me. It really was. And that time Michael, Gussie and Paddy Russell would have been playing at the fireplace, you know, and it was...
But you were an old rock and roller then. Was this your first introduction to what you'd call the heart of traditional music?
Yeah, definitely. It really was. I wasn't really a rock and roller at that time. I mean, I'd started writing songs, all right. And the year before I'd done my first ever paid gigs, I was the opening act to Planxty. I got 20 quid a night. We did about 5 or 6 huge gigs around Ireland, which were absolutely terrifying, but the addiction kicked in right there and then. But coming to Doolin in 1973 with a bunch of friends from Newbridge, it was a real eye-opener. And I think what it was the sense that here is a place where music is part of the daily language of people's lives, and that every day people were bringing music into their lives in the same way that we in Kildare might talk about football or horse racing. Here was a place that tunes were just part of the everyday conversation, and I hadn't really experienced that before. And
4 decades on, does it still feel the same?
It's not the same, but I don't really mind that. I mean, you know, I can get as dewy-eyed as anybody else can about the 70s. But I also remember in the 1970s coming into a pub in Doolin at 7 o'clock in the evening and asking for a cup of coffee, and the barman frowning at me, and he said, "We don't serve food after 6. You know, and now there's 4 or 5 fantastic restaurants in Doolin. There's amazing cafes. There's a woman called Fabiola up the road beside the graveyard. She's a 2 Michelin star pastry chef who makes the most unbelievable cakes and chocolates and things that you'd die for. In other words, Doolin has been changed in the way that Ireland has been changed. But what I'm really thrilled about, and this weekend is a reflection of that, there still is amazing music being played by incredible musicians who also happen to be great characters, and I don't want any more.
Luca Bloom with Philip King. Well, I leave you now with the song from Luca with Steve Cooney on guitar. It's a song about Robin Hood. Gurmahagavas Rogoluther, Tasulam Gurwanshiv, Saltas Glor, August Gamishiv Lum Takanamakiana, and Tuckthin Chahugin, Gajishin, Gajeshiv Slan.
It's funny how hot is the sun now that you can't run away from the city. Lie there and think of the deer you have run, of all the games that you've played, and wondering what Marion's bound to do that's better than coming to see you one last time. No more Robin, no more. Your outlaw days are over. Time's taken your time away. Time and deceptions have whittled you down. All of the times that ever you had have took to their heels and run. Hold on to whatever is closest to you. It's all Lonesome Robin can do. One last time. No more Robin, no more. Your outlaw days are over.